This is Jeff Blankford. My guest today on Takes on the World, Susie Hansen, is an American journalist and editor who's lived in Istanbul for the past decade. She is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, for which she writes mainly on Turkish politics, and has written about foreign affairs for publications such as the London Review of Books, Vogue, GQ, Bloomberg Businessweek, among many other publications. Before moving to Turkey, Hansen worked as an editor at Salon.com and spent 7 years with the New York Observer. In 2007, she was awarded a journalism fellowship from the Institute of Current World Affairs, which allowed her to move to Turkey, and since then she has traveled for her work to Libya, Greece, Egypt, Afghanistan, Kuwait, India, and Kenya. As a result of her experiences in Turkey and beyond, and looking back with a critical eye at the USA, she has produced one of the most important, refreshingly honest books I've ever had the pleasure to read. It's called Notes on a Foreign Country, An American Abroad in a Post-American World, about which we are going to speak this morning. Welcome to Takes on the World, Susie Hansen.
Thank you so much for having me.
It was really refreshing. We've had fires here, so I'm still in the midst of reading it. But what I've read really is something that all Americans need to read. Your travels, your adventures, your coming of age intellectually as an American citizen fully formed is quite wonderful. But let's begin.
Thank you.
With what brought and led you to settle in Turkey, one of Washington's most important and oftentimes most difficult and controversial allies, and perhaps no more so than at this moment?
Well, it's a kind of strange story because I did, as you said, as you mentioned, I won this fellowship, and it was a journalism fellowship. And the idea was that you would go abroad for 2 years and you would intensely immerse yourself in a foreign country, and you could choose the country when you applied. And I chose Turkey in part because I did not know much about any other countries. I didn't know anything about Turkey either. So it was sort of random. But what I did realize was that after September 11th, a lot of journalists were moving to Iraq and Afghanistan to cover the wars. And they were learning about the Arab world. They were learning about Islam. They were learning about the Middle East. But very little was being written about Turkey. And I think I saw it as perhaps an opportunity. And I think that the other reason, though, I mean, the sort of what I call in the book the secret reason, was that my favorite writer, who is James Baldwin, lived in Istanbul on and off for about a decade. And I had seen this documentary about his life. And in it, he said that he felt more comfortable in Istanbul than he had felt in Paris or New York. And this didn't make any sense to me because I didn't understand how that was possible. I didn't know anything about Turkey, and I assumed that, you know, the eastern part of the world was sort of behind us in terms of liberal ways of thinking. And I had, of course, no idea what it was like to be a black man in Paris and New York in the 40s and 50s. So I should have had a better idea by that point. And in any case, Istanbul, this image of Baldwin walking through the old city that was in the documentary, really kind of captured my imagination. And I started to think, well, maybe there is something much bigger for me to learn in Turkey. And I think that that was also happening at the same time when this was after September 11th. And after a period of introspection, I sort of felt like actually we stopped really looking at what had happened in the last 50 years to have produced such a terrible event. So all of these things sort of came together, and I moved to Turkey.
And you had certain ideas, kind of romantic notions about Turkey that many in the West still have about Kemal Atatürk and this great model democracy that was supposed to be replicated, like a combination of Islam and Western thought. And you found out from talking to Turkish friends that this wasn't the case. And you also met some amazing people who became your mentors, from a Turkish miner to another individual who kind of bounced thoughts off of you and expanded your mind. It's an amazing story.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I learned so much in that first year that I lived in Turkey. It's kind of amazing. And the process was sort of like being stripped of all your preconceived notions. I mean, I had read books about Turkey. I had read a lot of newspaper articles and essays about Turkey. But it's really an entirely different experience when you actually get to a place and you're seeing things with your own eyes. And also when you understand that, you know, journalism very often reduces foreign countries to these kind of simple, you know, characteristics. It's sort of, with Turkey, it was the Islamists versus the secularists. And then, of course, you arrive, and just like any country, just like ours, it is so much more complex. And those identities actually don't really make sense at all. And of course, yes, I mean, the Turks could tell me, and Kurds could tell me, a lot of complex things about Kemal Atatürk. But the story that Westerners chose to tell themselves about Kemal Atatürk was a different one. And so that was why I came with all of those ideas about him. And I arrived there at the time when, you know, also Recep Tayyip Erdogan was running for office again. It was the 2007 election. His party was running for office. And it was this kind of extraordinarily, you know, kind of turbulent time, but also a very hopeful time, that for the first time there was going to be a party that was not only more religious in some ways, but also, some people believed at that time, more democratic. So it was just kind of like being thrown into a complicated situation and struggling to understand it. But I really wasn't understanding it, as I discovered later.
One interesting aspect, you begin at the beginning of your book, where you talk with a survivor of a Turkish mine disaster in 2014, and when you ask him about the protection of the unions, he points to something I'm quite familiar with, is the role the AFL-CIO had in helping to form the union. Perhaps you could go into that.
Well, yeah, so by this point, when I reported that story, I had been in Turkey for 7 years. So I think that's important to note, because my point in including that scene is that it's 7 years later, and I'm still surprised by these things. And that was not, I think, something that's particular about me. I think it's the resilience of our sort of narrative that we have about the world and how difficult it is to change that. So basically, you know, this young miner, this miner who had survived the mine fire, and it was a terrible mine fire, 301 people died. And, you know, one of the miners said to me, you know, why hadn't you come to visit us before? Why did you come after the fire? And, you know, the real true reason why was because I hadn't really done the work of investigating how Turkey's, you know, sort of people had endured the, you know, vast and very rapid privatization and sort of rush toward capitalism in the last 10 years. And, you know, that was kind of, and that was the truth as to why I had never really investigated what was going on with the mine, with the, you know, miners, for example, because obviously the reason why the mine fire happened was because nobody was actually tending to the mine or had any, upholding any kind of safety rules. But then in the process of all of this, what I also learned was that the union that these miners worked for had very long ago in the 1940s, or that they belonged to, had very long in the 1940s, had been established with the help of the Americans. And one of the miners pointed this out to me, and that, you know, that it was part of an effort on the part of the Americans during the Cold War to subtly or directly shape the political movements in Turkey so that they would not be too leftist and they would be more, let's say, capitalistic or more sympathetic or more vulnerable to business. So, I mean, you can understand where this story goes, and it wasn't just that establishment of the union. You know, it was also that in the 1980s, there were some leftist unions that had, you know, come about in Turkey, but they were shut down by a military coup that the Americans supported. So I think, again, what this experience all meant to me was that here I was doing this reporting, and it wasn't just about a mine fire. It was about the last 60 years of history.
One of the things that impresses me in the book is that reached out to me is when you spoke about our country's terrible innocence about our own deeds, and this is part of them. We're ignorant about how the government used the AFL-CIO, or as George Bush Sr. once accidentally said at their meeting in New York and Washington, D.C., he referred to them as the AFL-CIA, and everybody laughed. and most
right.
The American AFL-CIO was spending more money in the Cold War trying to overthrow U.S. enemies than it was organizing American workers, which saw the decline of the American working class at the very same time. But Americans simply, and even American workers, are not hip to this, but this innocence, which comes out throughout the book, that we're like an elephant that steps on the grass, and people's histories, as you write, the history of other peoples cannot be written without looking at the role of the United States in shaping those histories. Perhaps you could elaborate on that.
Well, yeah, I think that there's a particular, you know, a lot of us are products of the Cold War. I mean, this was, I think, something that I didn't quite realize because we, you know, as someone who came of age in the 90s or was in college in the 90s anyway, you know, we won the Cold War, right? That was basically how it was discussed. And it was sort of a closed book. We never went back to look at it. We never examined it. We were just, you know, happy. We won it, basically. It was all very triumphalist. And so I didn't realize the degree to which my own mind and my own way of thinking about the rest of the world and my country had been very much produced by that sort of, you know, 40s, 50s era. And I think that, you know, when we talk about ignorance, I mean, my point, I do have a lot of history in the book because I wanted to point out some of the things that I personally had not known and that were very important to me to learn about some of the historical events. But there's, on the one hand, ignorance and facts, right? And there's also the sort of emotional relationship to that history. Knowing these things is not just, you know, is not the entire story here. It's also, you know, recognizing that this history is part of you, that it has shaped you, that it has shaped your personality, and that it has shaped this relationship that you have with the rest of the world, and it has shaped their lives as well. And I think that that is something that Americans tend to be particularly disconnected from. Whereas when I went abroad and I was interviewing people, if I was interviewing, for example, about the Greek financial crisis in 2010, and I would kind of say to them in this, the way that journalists do, I would say, you know, hey, what happened here? How did you get into this mess? You know, sort of, you know, with that kind of attitude, tell me the story. What happened? You know, I'm expecting them to tell a story that goes back 10 years. They end up telling a story that they say, well, hey, look, you know, honestly, this starts with 1946, 1949, the Greek Civil War, and the American intervention. And at that point, that's when they're making a gesture as if they're almost saying, you know, hey, cousin, you know what that was about. And of course, I didn't. But I also had no way then of understanding how that history, which is a history of power, and my country was a country in power, of course, produced me. It produced the way I might be looking at Greece. It produced prejudices and biases and everything else. And I was just completely unconscious of that. And this struck me as, you know, as a journalist, as very much a moral failure.
Well, you're not alone, because if you look at the history books that U.S. students get in their high schools, you would not know the United States intervened in Greece. You would not know so much of this history, the interventions, because it's essentially a whitewash. And unless you have a teacher who is going to push you to go beyond what's in the textbook, and now with the core we have Common Core in the country, and teachers have to teach to the test, it's even more of a challenge. But the reality, the American people are largely ignorant of their history and the footprint that we have made in the world. And one other thing.
Yes. Oh, well. I mean, I was just going to say, I think that part of the problem with this is that whenever a teacher may try to introduce this, or whenever someone brings this up, he has a leftist. But in a way, this is sort of code for bad, right? It's sort of, we always have to kind of divide ourselves into good and bad. It's like, were we good or were we bad? Did we do bad things? Did we do good things? This is part of the problem, right? It's not being able to just see this as reality, and our government as a government, you know, as something that has, you know, both has these sort of practical, dark, and ugly sometimes, you know, interests. And we can't just face that, because we're very attached to this idea that we're good. And this seems to be the problem in terms of assessing our history as well. Sorry, I cut you off there.
No, quite all right. It's the Pledge of Allegiance to this. Where we're supposed to have liberty and justice for all, or we're the paragons of liberty and democracy, where we had centuries of slavery and Jim Crow. And one of the things we cannot allow even an American president, if he even so desires, not a she yet, but he desires, to apologize for any crime we've committed. When President Obama went to Japan, to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, he was told and warned not to apologize, but then, which he didn't, but then he came and went to Laos and Vietnam, where they who did not attack us at all, of course, and we killed millions of them. People there in both countries. Don't know how many people we killed in Laos. We have no stats for that.
A lot, yeah.
But he didn't apologize either one of those countries, and he offered $50,000, $50 million, you know, chump change, to help the Laotians still find unexploded ordnance. It's an incredible situation where America will not, Americans viscerally will not accept responsibility for anything that we have done in the world, including the refugee problem in Europe. Today.
Yeah, no, it's really incredible. I mean, I had someone say to me recently after this book was released, and he was a very intelligent man and a liberal, frankly. And he said, you know, you bring up all of these things that we did in your book and including assassinating world leaders. And he said, you know, doesn't everybody have blood on their hands? And it's sort of like, wait a minute, you know, and especially you're bringing up Hiroshima and Laos, which are two just, as you say, extraordinary examples and are really, truly crimes. I mean, it's sort of amazing. We're talking about murder here. I mean, we're talking about death. And I think that one of the major problems here is that Americans have not, you know, ever had to face, you know, thank God, but have never had to face this kind of death on this scale, whereas they have caused it on this scale. And we do not feel a kind of empathy or an emotional connection to the deaths of these people, which I think is a fairly terrible indictment of a society, or a very troubling one and a dangerous one.
My guest is Susie Hansen. We're talking about her book, Notes on a Foreign Country, An American Abroad in a Post-American World, published by Farrar, Giroux, and Strauss. And a book I recommend, strongly recommend. I'm still, every page has something really interesting, exciting. Learning Ataturk's daughter was the first female pilot. And what did she do? She bombed the Kurds, killed thousands of Kurds. I was not aware of that, nor was actually aware of James Baldwin's time in Istanbul, and that you found him as you're channeling him, in a sense, in this book, which he would be very happy to know.
Trying.
He lives through your pages. I have to say
well,
that.
I was lucky to have him.
Well, he's lucky to have you, because that aspect of Baldwin we don't hear about, and then I find it in your book was really a breath of fresh air, and you bring him up throughout the book. You know, before you went on the air, I do a kind of introductory commentary. I was talking about the examples of empire. Rex Tillerson, our Exxon Secretary of State, has now told foreign fighters, Iranians, in Iraq to go home. He said foreign fighters need to go home. Americans obviously are not foreign. They are troops of the world. I mean, as the cops of the world, and so they don't go home. But that he could say this, and people there obviously look at that and they just shake their heads and they just, this is the Americans. I mean, they simply have no sense of where they are or where we are on the planet.
Well, can I say
sure.
that was a doubly embarrassing thing for him to say. As far as I understand, Iraq is not a country I know very well, but as far as I understand, those fighters he's talking about are Iraqi. I think that they are they are funded and aided by Iran, and maybe there are some Iranian fighters too, but a lot of them are Iraqi. So anyway, I think that he made a mistake when he was talking about that. There's a double standard in almost everything that our leaders say. I mean, it's fairly extraordinary. I mean, even to a certain degree, you could look at the nuclear the controversy over the nuclear deal with Iran. I mean, you know, you just have to sort of take many steps back for a second and just ask, like, well, we have nuclear weapons. Why don't they get one? I mean, it's just sort of it's kind of mind-boggling the way that this thinking works.
Well, we simply don't recognize the sovereignty of other countries. I mean, here is Israel has been threatening Iran And actually would have understand, at least according to the Israeli press, Netanyahu wanted to launch an attack on Iran, but he was stopped from doing that by his military officials. And so here is Iran threatened by Israel all the time. I mean, publicly, not just silently, and they're not allowed to have weapons to defend themselves. And here is this country of 80 million people, much larger than Iraq, and actually, I believe, threatens Israel, is Iran becoming an economic powerhouse, and which is and because they're very well-educated public Americans have no idea of what happens in Iran. I haven't been to Iran. I've been to the Middle East, but not there. But this is...
It's an incredible place. It's an incredible place and will be an economic powerhouse, probably, I would imagine.
One, I want to actually go back to some of the history that you bring up in the book, which is really important that I didn't know. You talk about a book called The Passing of Traditional Society by a Daniel Lerner, published in 1958, in which he collected, Mr. Lerner collected research in a tiny village in Anatolia in Turkey. And this was, the idea was to impose American ideas of modernization on the whole region. Perhaps you could talk about that.
Yeah, I think this was one of the most important things that I discovered, and I think that a lot of you know, maybe students of political science and various other fields do study this, and it is a widely now discredited theory, modernization theory. But I think that, as far as I can understand, to me, it still informs you know the rhetoric surrounding foreign countries and foreign policy, the language that we use, the way that we look at those countries. I mean, I think it's still very much present in our lives. Even if academia and if, you know, a lot of policy circles have discredited it, and it continues, you know, it's sort of spirit lives on, which was basically that after World War II and France and Britain and the European powers retreating, they were sort of, you know, retreating also from their colonial outposts and recognizing they can't do this anymore. And so the United States had at its feet, you know, the entire world or the so-called third world, that they now had to, in their minds, take care of, right, or sort of take over. It was an opportunity. And so they, I mean, quite literally, and I think that this is important and a little bit chilling, is, you know, a bunch of intellectuals at Harvard and MIT with the funding of the CIA, some of them who ended up working, or at least one ended up working for Kennedy, Walt Rousseau. I mean, these men sat around a table, and they basically constructed, should think about American foreign policy. And the way that what they came up with was modernization theory. And it was essentially a replacement for colonialism. I mean, these Americans knew that you could not use the word colonialism anymore. That was racist. They knew that that wasn't going to look very good. They knew that they didn't really want to be a part of that because they were different. They were Americans, and they don't do
and
that.
They were liberals.
they were liberals, and so instead they refashioned it is this idea of modernization because they were going to go into these countries, and they were going to bring them the tools to modernize. Modernize meaning really like a handful of things. I wish I had it in front of me because it's a very darkly funny list. But one of them, for example, was urbanization. I mean, a lot of these countries were very much encouraged to urbanize, which, as you can imagine, was also quite traumatic for a lot of people, probably lifted a lot of people out of poverty. But I mean, I think that that's arguable because they probably ended up in poverty in those cities anyway. But anyway, so essentially there was a list of things that these countries would do. And, you know, they would also be heading towards democracy as an American-style democracy, hopefully, maybe someday, but more importantly, a capitalist system. And why? Because the Americans, as they had been for the last 25 years, wanted access to these markets, and they also wanted these countries to be, you know, in some ways bound to them. And their primary countries, and there's sort of good intentions. And some of the scholars of this period do still say that they had good intentions. I'm sometimes surprised because it seems so sinister to me, but that, you know, though the Americans always had good intentions and Kennedy had good intentions and that they really just wanted to go in and this was before Kennedy, by the way, the modernization started in the late 40s, but that they wanted to kind of go in and help these people modernize, i.e. become more like us. And that is why, to this day, that word modernize and modernization has such a positive ring to us. But it doesn't necessarily have a positive ring to the rest of the world. To Iranians, for example, modernization might mean the Shah. And the Shah was a brutal ruler who, you know, put a lot of people in prison, tortured them, and killed them. So, you know, but he was our primary modernizer. And the reason why that was that at some point they realized that these countries, in their minds being such a mess, needed heavy-handed rulers or military dictators or dictators to be administering this process of modernization in the country, and they needed to be our military dictators. And that's kind of how we ended up with the mess we ended up with in the 60s, 70s, and 80s and everything else.
My guest again is Susie Hansen. We're talking about her book, Notes on a Foreign Country, An American Abroad in a Post-American World. It's interesting that the neocons came along. Well, actually, they began in the 70s, but they came along in the 80s and 90s and with the idea of promoting democracy. They said democracy, but it was kind of proven to be a little contradictory when the Iraqi people, they took a poll, and 96%, excuse me, the Turkish people took a poll, 96% did not want Turkey to be involved in the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And Paul Wolfowitz made some critical comments about Turkey's democracy. It shouldn't be allowed to get in the way of U.S. foreign policy. Briefly, Turkey has long been one of America's most like kind of controversial, difficult allies because Erdogan is a personality which cannot be contained, and we're trying to tell him, the United States, that he can't trade with Iran, and he can't barter with Iran. Our sanctions are, most people don't realize, are not just primary sanctions to Iran, but they're secondary sanctions against any country in the world that will deal with Iran. So we are dictating the foreign policy of other countries in the world. And this is not even discussed or debated, even mentioned in the columns in our newspapers. It's an extraordinary situation. And today we have a battle of visas between Turkey and Iran. What is it like for you as an American journalist in Turkey today?
Well, I'll just say about that, by the way. I mean, I have friends who work for – it's not just – America is having an effect on the businesses of Turkey because, you know, and ordinary people, because if they want to continue – I mean, Turkey has done business with many of the countries around it, even if it doesn't necessarily have, you know, the best political or, you know, surface-level political relationship with it. And they do a lot of business with, you know, and do business with Iran, and they have a terrible time. They've been having a terrible time. I mean, it's a nightmare. So it's really far-reaching. And, I mean, sanctions, I think, are another thing that just don't seem to have inspired much of a moral debate in the U.S., even despite the fact of the horror of Iraqi sanctions in the 90s and the early 2000s. So it's kind of, that's a kind of another astonishing topic as far as I'm concerned. And of course we never have sanctions placed on us, which, you know, but as an American now, I mean, I'm just returning after 2 months in the States. And so I haven't really gotten a good sense of how much this visa dispute is affecting things, but I didn't suspect it would affect daily life very much, and as from what I hear, it's not. Turks are very pragmatic. They are used to Americans. They know that there's a difference between individuals and the government, and I have always felt fine here. Where you're going to see the ugliness is perhaps in some of the government newspapers, on Twitter, online maybe, but I mean, face-to-face, I would be surprised if there are that many ugly things happening ever. I mean, I'm never really sure what people are curious about when they ask the question of how does it feel to be an American there. But I would say that there's an uptick in so-called, you know, anti-Americanism that the government is definitely whipping up. It's very, you know, it's fun for everyone. so that is happening. But otherwise, I've always had a nice time living here. Yeah, that's why I'm still here.
The polls do show that the population is overwhelmingly anti-America these days. Like 78% have an unfavorable view of the United States, particularly at the moment. No, I've been to Turkey a couple of times, just briefly, so I can't speak with any kind of knowledge. And mostly in Istanbul and outside of it, but I find it's necessary to be in a place for not just a few days, but a length of time to know what it's like, to get a sense of it. And you can't do that in a
Excuse me. I mean, one thing I would say about that 78% number, because I think that this is very helpful for Americans to understand and often isn't explained, that is because of this long history that America has had with Turkey. It is because of this belief that in this 50, you know, from the beginning, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and up until today. But, you know, of course, the Cold War was very, very intense, that America has been meddling in its affairs. And so it has always had these feelings. And it's not just Erdogan's people. It's leftists. It's all people of all different stripes. So I think sometimes people think that this is just Erdogan's people or something, but I mean, leftists are probably more anti-American in certain ways. So it's a very complicated topic, actually. But you know, at the same time, there are certain things that they like about America as well. You know, they know the country fairly well, and then they have paranoia, a certain amount of paranoia about how it might be meddling, because it used to meddle, or it often does. And right now, the big issue is Fethullah Gulen, who is, you know, accused of staging the military coup in 2016, and who lives in the United States, and who many Turks believe is in some way supported by the United States. And that's the big issue right now.
I've wondered about that myself, because he doesn't give interviews, and he's obviously living in a much guarded compound in Pennsylvania. I thought from my Western perspective somewhat, that this was an excuse for cracking down. But evidently, Gulen does have a lot of influence and was at one point a close comrade, compatriot of Erdogan.
I'm glad you mentioned this, because I think this is a serious problem right now in terms of the understanding between the United States and Turkey. I think that some people believe that this, you know, Gulen is being used as a straw man, scapegoat, whatever you want to call it. I think that does not, and we don't, I mean, I don't personally know what happened the night of the military coup, but many Turkish journalists who I trust and who I admire have done the work of examining the documents, and they certainly believe that they were involved in some way, if not heavily. But what I will say about that is that there's another thing here, which is that yes, I mean, Gulen and Erdogan, the Gulen people were very much running the many ministries of the government with Tayyip Erdogan. They were allies, and the Gulen movement is highly educated. Erdogan needed them, and they came together in a marriage of convenience because they didn't like each other before. They're from different, you know, Islamic brotherhoods and communities. But also there's something else that's important to know, which is that the Turkish people have been struggling to understand and struggling with this Gulen community for a long time, in the sense that a lot of people have been worried that they are wielding influence in universities or in secondary schools or in various other segments of society, and that they are an exclusive group and one to be concerned about and one that wants power. You know, they obviously, the movement is also made up of ordinary Turkish people who, you know, want nothing but to be part of this brotherhood because it's, you know, sort of solidarity and et cetera, and also, you know, is a warm Islamic community. But I just think that it should be understood that there's a lot of people in Turkey who really are just struggling with this understanding this movement.
Well, it's a complicated one, because it appears that the United States has resisted under various administrations in protecting Gulen and keeping him out of sight. And there's no so I understand Erdogan is playing that card as well in to the Turkish people. But his relations now, it's interesting, with another thing with Putin and Iran, that Putin has been trying to obviously break a wedge or cause a wedge between Washington and its Middle Eastern allies in order to fend off the U.S. moves toward Russia with NATO on its borders. It's a complicated world and very difficult for most Americans to comprehend, and most actually don't even make an effort, and they don't even think about it. So maybe ignorance is bliss, but not on this radio program. Susie Hansen, of Notes on a Foreign Country, An American Abroad in a Post-American World. Rush to one of our local independent bookstores and order it and ask why they don't have it. No, I should say they may have it. But I do recommend this book. It's a marvelous book, and I've learned so much myself, and I also had so many of my own ideas reinforced. So thank you so much for that and being our guest today on Takes on the World. Thanks so much, Susie Hansen.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed talking with you.
My pleasure.
And I hope everyone in California is okay. It's been heartbreaking to see what's happening.
Yeah, we had, yes, it's been really difficult times, and it's still, for people just south of us in Sonoma County and Santa Rosa, it's still going on. So we lost a number of people up here. So thanks so much anyway for thinking about it, and I look forward to talking to you again. About Turkey.
Okay, me too.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
You
Take
too.
Care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.